You're listening to the Study Legal English podcast, helping lawyers and law students become fluent in legal English. For more information, visit studylegalenglish.com. Hello and welcome to the Study Legal English podcast. I'm your host Louise, and today you're going to be listening to an interview with Alex Hamilton. If you listened to the last two podcast episodes, episode 96.1 and episode 96.2, you will have heard Sarah Fox talking about her concept of the 500-word contract. Today, we are following on from this idea. This time, we're looking at a law firm implementing innovative ideas in their contracting to show you that this can be done by a firm with big commercial clients. I'm talking huge global investment banks, multinational telecommunications clients, big deals, and big companies. And I must admit, I'm in love with what Alex is doing at Radiant Law. Oh my God, throughout the interview, there were a few things that I found out that literally made my jaw drop. And Alex is just so casual about it. He's like, yeah, oh, by the way, yeah, we're kind of doing this and this. It's incredibly impressive. I'm so excited to be sharing his story with you. Now, a couple of things to mention. I want to give a shout out to Omar Almana, who sent in an answer to my question from episode 95 on employment law, which was, are you an employment lawyer? Do you want to be? And why? I didn't manage to get this into the last episode, so I'm getting it in now. Omar said, so I have a position in this field and every day I'm reading how I can draft employment contracts or reading labour law. I feel in the future this will help me in my job. Brilliant, Omar. This is a great attitude towards studying. I wish you all the best in your work. If you have comments about the interview today, please send me in your comments to louise@studylegalenglish.com. Finally, a quick announcement. If you're a member, you'll get your transcripts for this episode. And if you're a pro member, you'll get a couple of bonus episodes, a summary for those in a rush, and a vocabulary episode doing a deep dive into vocabulary used in this interview. So let's go.
Today, we've got a real treat for you listeners. You've probably heard of big law, trad law, magic circle law firms, but have you heard of new law? If you don't know what it is, you're going to find out today because I'm very pleased to have a total rule breaker on the show. In the words of Ken Adams, who many of you know who he is, Ken Adams refers to this man as the ever raffish Alex Hamilton. Alex is the CEO of Radiant Law, a new law firm leading the way in optimizing how large companies create, negotiate, and manage their commercial contracts. Alex has come from the world of tradition. He's worked for large global law firms, the likes of Norton Rose, Shaw Pittman, and he was a partner at Latham & Watkins. But in 2011, that all changed when he set up his own firm, Radiant Law, to do things differently. If you're interested in future law, you will have heard the name Alex Hamilton. You will have heard the name Radiant Law before because they are synonymous with innovation. And Alex is absolutely synonymous with innovation. He's been recognized by the Financial Times Innovation Lawyer Awards. So he knows what he's talking about. I met Alex a while ago in 2018 at the Legal English event in London. He was a speaker, and I remember two particular things from his talk. I mean, a lot of it I didn't understand because I'm not a tech lawyer, and a lot of the concepts were new to me. But I had two real key takeaways. They were traditional law firm structures and too much focus on legal risk are stifling innovation and efficiency. And secondly, that AI, artificial intelligence, all of this focus on AI at the moment, these trends. Well, AI isn't a magic wand. It's not going to fix all of your problems. Stop obsessing about this and actually make some changes that Alex is suggesting instead. So I was quite intrigued by Alex then. I have been following him on LinkedIn since then, and you listeners all should do that too. I'm going to leave a link to his LinkedIn profile in the show notes. So, what a big introduction. And also, finally, before we go and welcome Alex to the show, what I love about Alex and what you're going to discover today, listeners, is that Alex, he doesn't just sit around complaining about all of the things that are wrong with the world and talking about change. He is doing it, and he's interested, genuinely interested in you doing it too. So, hi, Alex.
Wow. Wow. Hi, Louise. That's a hell of an introduction. Thank you very much. Great to be here.
At the moment, you're in South Africa.
I am sitting this out in South Africa, this debacle, and it's very nice here. Marvelous.
Yes. Here. Well, great to have you on the show. I'm so excited to have you on the show, and also a little nervous because because you really know what you're talking about, and I'm certainly nervous because I'm sure some of it I'll probably have to clarify some words and things as we go along. You certainly are the guy to be talking to about innovation. So let's go straight into the questions. First of all, can you give us a bit of background about how you got to where you are today?
So I used to be a real lawyer. I was, you said the kind of traditional thing. I was a technology and outsourcing lawyer. And I think that's quite an interesting combination of the three, right, of kind of being very into how technology could be applied, the opportunities of outsourcing as a business model, and then the legal industry. So I did that. And then I had this kind of Jerry Maguire midlife crisis kind of moment. Back in 2009, I think it was, and I wrote this kind of mission statement and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so the upshot is that you can't change big law, and big law is doing brilliantly without my ideas. Anyway, just talks good talk. And ended up founding Radiant as a firm to try to do things differently. So my starting point is that incentives matter and business structures matter, like you said in the introduction. And that if you incentivize people to do work in a certain way, they will work in that way. And then you will get frustrated if it's inefficient or whatever, but nothing will change until you change the structure. So we set up Radiant a little bit differently. No timesheets, fixed price only, lots of tech, lots of process. Most of the legal team are actually in Cape Town, which is why I'm here, but an English law firm, and trying to reinvent contracting. So we just do commercial contracts and come to it with an opinion that contracting is generally deeply broken and problematic, that if you really think the real purpose is to create great commercial relationships quickly, we're not doing a great job at that. And at Radiant, we're trying to figure out how to do it better.
I think you're already doing it better and constantly changing and adapting, it sounds like. Let's talk a little bit about this. What is new law? A lot of the listeners out there won't really know what new law is. It can be a new concept to quite a lot of them. What is new law?
It's a pigeonhole, and I don't think we fit totally brilliantly in anything. Anyone does, but the current commentators in the market trying to make sense of what's going on. What seems to have happened is that there was a fairly traditional model that's done brilliantly well in supporting, we work in supporting companies, so kind of a focus on that rather than consumer law. There's a pretty traditional model of supporting companies, sometimes called the cravat model, of a kind of partnership system with kind of lawyers going through an apprenticeship and then coming up in the kind of the elastic tournament, as it's been described by commentators, that tends to be charged by the hour, and a very lucrative business model, right? And as Richard Susskind, the John the Baptist of the new law movement, always argued, it's hard to tell a room full of millionaires they're doing it wrong. So that's kind of big law, traditional law. And you've had bigger law firms, obviously they've scaled up over the years, and you've had smaller partnerships, but they're generally law has been delivered by partnerships using quills, right? New law is fundamentally querying a number of parts of this model. We happen to be a law firm, but a lot of people in the new law world aren't actually law firms. They call themselves law companies or law, whatever, they tend to be greater emphasis on technology, stronger emphasis on process, probably a wider range of skills being brought to bear than just lawyers doing lawyering, and different pricing models, typically not charging by the hour. There's the kind of similarities. After that, there are many, many different flavors, which is why it's a slightly uncomfortable pigeonhole, because there's so many of us being put into it, but we're perfectly happy with the label as it is. You know, we ain't big law, that's for sure.
Good. That's the important point.
Yeah.
Great. So you mentioned at first when I asked you about, you know, how you got to where you are today, and you spoke about Radiant Law, because I was going to ask you about how you did things differently. And you've kind of mentioned a few things there, like you've spoken about that you don't have timesheets, which there are going to be listeners out there which are like, what? Like, what are you talking about? Can you, for a listener out there who's in a traditional law firm setting, who's like, this is my, got to get my bread and butter and do my billable hours. What's this guy, what's this maverick talking about? Can you explain?
Right. Crazy talk,
Alex.
Yeah, well, you know, you get what you incentivize, right? So if you measure hours, you get hours. And we seem to have got ourselves in a bit of a pickle in the legal industry. We're thinking that more lawyering is per se a good thing, and that the value of lawyers comes from lawyering, and you just pile on more of it, you should pay for more of it. And if it takes longer, you should pay more. And, you know, I don't think your average business user of this is terribly impressed by this thinking, but they've kind of to date been, generally speaking, stuck with having to buy it that way. But, you know, if we take a step back, what we're trying to do here is create as much value for clients as quickly as possible, as efficiently as possible, which minimizes the amount of time spent on it and focuses on things that add the most value. So it seems to me that a mindset around more hours is a good thing is the wrong mindset. So in order to change this, we had to get rid of timesheets and to change the whole way of thinking about it, right? And instead, you know, we talk about outputs and, you know, how much have we, contracts have we done and so on. And we want to do that as efficiently as possible, as well as possible, focus on the things that matter the most, so that we can all spend more time in the pub. That's the thinking. You know, it's no prizes for working past midnight. Now, what we found is that when you actually start thinking about the world slightly differently like this, turns out there are all sorts of things you can do to be much, much faster and much better in terms of delivering value, and that, you know, time per se is not a great measure or thing.
So just to pause you there, because it sounds like you're going to go on to tell me all these other things that you can do. But before we do that, can I ask, so if you don't do timesheets and billable hours, what do you, like, how do you charge your clients?
We fix price everything and we agree everything in advance, right? And so it might be a big deal and we're just like, you know, this is the price and it is what it is. If you don't know what the price should be, you probably shouldn't be in this industry anyway. So, you know, kind of that is what it is. And funnily enough, when you actually do that, then you get more efficient at it, not less. Most of what we do is kind of working for big companies, fast-growing companies with their day-to-day contracts. And there we'll charge, you know, typically a flat monthly amount or amount per contract or, you know, some combination, but it's still a fixed price per contract and output. And then, you know, the next question I'm always asked is, well, okay, right, well, how do you know what your lawyers are doing, right? And we go, well, you know, pretty much every employee in the world these days doesn't actually fill in timesheets. So, you know, how do they manage them is the obvious answer, but, you know, lawyers don't accept that. So kind of the next thing is, well, we have some measures of output. So we have our own system we built for tracking all the work, make sure we're doing well and make sure we're getting it out and not losing track of anything. So we've got that. And so I know exactly how much any given lawyer is delivering in terms of actual contracts done. So, and we do get the team to roughly allocate percentages of their times to different accounts. It's only 100%, right? So you could have worked 3 hours a day or 12 hours a day. You're still allocating 100% of the month on, you know, different activities, roughly. You know, doesn't have to be exact. And that gives us profitability analysis and so on. A good enough view into it. It's a good enough metric, but it doesn't encourage people to work late. And I'm really keen to encourage people to work smart and to figure out how to get rid of work rather than figure out how to work past midnight every day. It doesn't seem to be a very healthy way of approaching life.
Which seems to be, I mean, you know, that's the incentive inside quite a lot of law firms is to kind of show that you're putting in the hours, to show that you're doing the work, staying late is better. I had an interviewee a while ago who talked about desk sitting. People right. just sit at their desks and not do anything, but just to be seen that they were there. And your system sounds a lot more healthy, and also you're going to incentivize better work, hopefully.
Yeah. So I mean, I'll give you an example, a recent example, right?
Yeah.
So we're huge proponents of lean, you know, the Toyota production system, applying it to legal services, and have a wonderful professor who comes in every Thursday to work with us and the team. So you know, we're a lot of thinking about how to improve things. And one of the big challenges we've been going through as a firm successfully is trying to get to half-day turnarounds for 75% of our matters. So that is, you get instructions in half a day, you have created the contract or turn the contract if it's a draft from the other side. And that's pretty fast, right? I think we're about the fastest on the planet now. You know, the average in our industry is about 2 days if you're a higher end thing. If you're in-house, no one even tracks it, let alone, you know, can tell you. I can't even tell you how many contracts they're doing in a year, but you know, they're certainly not tracking it. They're certainly not running it half day. I know that. So we've now got it to half day through a whole bunch of stuff, structuring the firm, technology, process, all the rest of it. There's no way we could have done that if we'd incentivized more time on matters, right? We've just had our third month now of a perfect 100 net promoter score. So at the end of every deal, we ping our clients and say, you know, the business users, the real users of the service, and say, score of, you know, 1 to 10, you know, everyone knows the question, how likely you to recommend us to your friend or colleague, right? And we've had a perfect score, that's 9s or 10s only, for the last 3 months, which is extraordinary. And that, I believe, has entirely come from the speed at which we're operating now, which has entirely come from thinking about it differently and not having timesheets. So it's all connected. And we had to kind of put that new business model in place in order to get to a place where we incentivize to do the right things to actually make our clients happy, which I kind of have got some evidence that we are doing right now.
Yes.
I mean, the problem is, of course, they'll all get used to it. So we'll go back to a typical 55, but you know, we'll figure out something.
You'll think of something else.
Yeah.
And so that half a day turnaround for a contract, that's incredible.
Interestingly, by the way, we halved the stress in the firm when we did that. What was happening is everyone was leaving everything. They went home at night, always knowing they were going to get something out the next day. And because we rearranged everything so they're able just to get good work done without being interrupted and, you know, made it fast and how quick they could do it, they never go home now stressed about what's going to go out the next day.
That's amazing.
So it was really positive side effects of this. And we also, on the way through, doubled productivity as well.
So yeah,
that's nice from a business owner perspective.
But, yeah, because I guess if you're allowing people to switch off after work, then you're going to have a team that's more satisfied, and also you're freeing up space for them to think, to innovate.
So the big focus is the day-to-day work, super important, got to do it really well, blah, 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 got to do it fast, and all the rest of it, all the other different metrics of what quality means. But is you've got to give them the space to think. Because what you really want to be working on, and this makes it more interesting, is not just churning contracts, but thinking about how to do that process better. And everyone at the firm is part of that continuous improvement. And that, to me, is actually the most fun of it all. It's not, I'm a deal junkie, I like doing deals and all the rest of it, but it's actually figuring out how to do deals smarter is I think, the most intellectually stimulating stuff at the work.
You also spoke about how, you know, traditional law firms, they have that, you know, this hierarchy where you come in as a trainee and you're working and you're trying to get all your billable hours in and win all the clients so that eventually you can become a partner. Do you have a hierarchy in your firm?
We're pretty flat. South Africa is interesting, actually, because it's quite hierarchical culture. So I keep going to the team, you're free, we're high, flat. And so on, and they go, that's great. Now tell me my career structure. So that's what can you do, eh? But it's interesting. We give a lot of responsibility to quite junior people as well. So you can run accounts and so on. And so you're kind of team-based working and everyone's running different parts of the firm, even the most junior person's leading some project on something. So it is all very different. We're very weird. It's quite interesting.
Weird, different.
Yeah,
what is it? There's a Steve Jobs quote that's like, here's to all the crazies, something. And
there you go.
I guess we can pop you in that under that quote. Radiant yeah. Law is a bunch of crazies doing crazy totally. Things.
That's the one.
are there other things in terms of the structure of your firm that is different to the traditional law firm that we haven't kind of touched on?
I suppose so. I mean, the obvious thing is we're not a partnership. So we run as a company and we have, you know, a board and an executive committee and so on, which I guess law firms do, but it's actually run as a company. And that's been great. But they don't teach you that at law school. So it's been a hell of a learning experience over the last 10 years, just learning how to do business, right? Be an entrepreneur and do all of that stuff. So that was been kind of an interesting learning curve. We've had, you know, wonderful people come in and teach us who just looked at us, you know, kind of gone, oh my God, you lawyers, you haven't a clue. I mean, the level of naivety and ignorance we set up this up with was quite spectacular. And it's been an interesting learning curve. But it has meant we were able to work with some really interesting business people and taught us a lot.
I mean, I think there's loads of like soft skills that you don't learn in law school that you kind of have to learn in real life. Yeah. I think the curriculum is massively lacking. But I guess as a company, it means that you could, in the kind of aims of your company, you can include, I mean, I know that the like key default aim of a company would be to maximize profit, but there's scope, I believe, if I remember from my company law days, of that you could potentially have other goals in there, like, for example...
Oh, no, we've done that. So
you've done it. There we go.
We are a B Corp. So we are a B Corp, which is like a fair trade for the whole company. So you have to be audited and certified and so on, which is kind of a good hygiene project to go through. So we are a certified nice company, at B Corp.
Very nice.
It's kind of an American movement that's kind of starting to open up around the world. And I think the only new law, maybe there's one in Australia, Hive, I think maybe there's one, so go to. But it's quite important to us. You know, we're kind of carbon neutral, and every contract we do for a client, we plant a tree. We're trying to do something a little bit more purposeful, I think. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Purposeful all around. Because that was actually what I was thinking of the environment. Because I was, my master's.
Yeah, we changed our articles. So the board is required to consider stakeholders and environment and all of these things as part of decision making. Yeah, you can do that.
Very, very interesting. I studied CSR as part of my master's in environmental law. And I remember that was part of the company law at 2015 or something like that.
Yeah. We don't have to be rapacious, you know, Friedman capitalists. Or Radiant's definitely not about that.
Good to earn a bit of money, but you're taking into account all of the other stuff. Excellent. That's something that I didn't know about Radiant Law. So moving on, I read an article of yours. It was a while back now, this article on LinkedIn. I'm going to leave a link for the listeners in the show notes. It's about AI and contract drafting.
Oh, yeah.
And this is also what you spoke about, what you like talking about, AI and contract drafting. How are most law firms using AI at the moment?
You know, I like to say they're mainly using it for press releases. So it's easier than actually changing. I'm a bit torn on this one because, you know, I'm the guy who loves technology. We build lots of technology. We use lots of technology. And I keep jumping up at conferences and going, yeah, but it's not really about technology. So I'm a bit torn. And I think what's happened is that we seem to have latched onto these kind of magic hand-waving solutions as a proxy for actually, you know, pretending we're doing stuff. And that's, you know, what's going on in the marketplace is there hasn't been much change, but there's been increasing desire for receiving and sending signals, and everyone's faking it. So everyone's faking it. The law firms aren't really changing, because I know, because I'm like mates with all the people behind the scenes, you know, who are meant to be doing the innovation and
stuff.
Don't name any names.
I don't want to.
I'm not going to name anyone. If I get drunk with them, I know what's actually going on at your law firm, right? So. And you're all lying through your teeth. That's what's going on, you know. And I've had partners, you know, go to me and go, oh yeah, we're doing AI so I can carry on doing exactly what I've always done, you know, hammering my client with billable hours. Nothing's changed. And that's what's happened, right? And then, you know, it's all the client's fault because they let them get away with it, right? They didn't really want to change their law firms. And they go, okay, give me a fig leaf so I can tell everyone that our law firms are actually, you know, adapting. And so the law firms have got into the fig leaf business. Well, that's not really changing. So in the context of all of that, AI or some blockchain nonsense or whatever, you know, takes on this role as, you know, a lot easier than really changing anything, right? But, you know, as I talk about, you know, AI is actually super useful in things like e-discovery and so on. But it's not talked about much because it's just become run-of-the-mill part of that kind of how that's done. But in our world of transactional law and contracting, there are limited uses for AI. Because what we're actually talking about when we use bandied terms around like that is we're talking about natural language processing and machine learning associated with identifying clause types. What the systems can do is with a reasonable level of accuracy and precision is they can identify whether this clause is a confidentiality clause or a force majeure termination clause or whatever else, right? But there's only so many things you can do with that ability. So it's kind of cool if you're doing an M&A due diligence and you can fire a bunch of paralegals because you can now throw a system at it to find the termination of a change of control clause. And that's great and all, but you know, your report's probably still unusable. And you can use it, you know, when you're doing contract reviews to find this thing or that thing. But most of what we do in contracting has nothing to do with identifying clauses this type or that type. And what AI can't do is tell you what the clause means. I mean, it can tell you that this is a termination for force majeure clause. So therefore, if you find in a contract, you've probably got a right to terminate force majeure. You can get that far, right? But it can't really interpret clauses and so on. And therefore, it's got really limited use. And we're nowhere close to solving that problem, right? The basic text's not there. You know, if you want to know more about this, you know, listeners, go read about Gary Marcus and what he's been arguing about this. He's sort of matching as we're talking about in this area. So, so AI is like, you know, magic, talked about in hushed tones, is used as a proxy instead of actually doing anything changing, and has a limited use. It's not no use. You know, there are uses for it, but it's limited use. It's certainly not going to solve it. And we've actually got some data, right? We actually know how you actually improve contracting. You've got all sorts of data. You follow me on LinkedIn, you'll see all sorts of articles. I start to share this data. We share quite a lot about what we do. And we know the things that actually speed up contracting and help you do it. And that comes down to stuff like a lot of hygiene around using short, clear, reasonable, relevant contract terms, for example, which is not glamorous or exciting, but actually works and actually has a major impact in the ability to close contracts quickly. We know that there are basic technologies that are all combinations of workflow, databases, and document transformation, things like e-signatures and document automation and little simple workflow stuff and so on, that actually works and is helpful and is easy to do and doesn't involve any AI whatsoever. We know that there are simple process improvements that will just get you, you know, to a place where it works. And it's not glamorous, but it can be done actually pretty easily. You can get going, you know, right now. It doesn't cost a lot of money. It's doable. It can be iteratively done. There's a logical order to it, in fact, because we kind of know that this is not totally virgin territory. We know kind of what works. And yet so few companies are actually doing it. And we've got data on that too, because we've got the Radiant benchmark. I know what companies are doing. And the answer is they're not doing the bloody basics. And they should be.
You mentioned that you share quite a lot of data and documents and things like that on Radiant Law and through your LinkedIn and things like that. And that's partly why at the beginning when I mentioned that, you know, you're a person who's interested in other people making change, because you're not someone who's like doing this research and keeping it all to yourself. You are sharing it with others. You're saying, look guys, this is the data, you guys can do this too. That's something that sets you apart, because a lot of firms, you know, are probably, well, not making the changes that you're making, but trying to do something, but then they're keeping all of this info to themselves. For example, there are a few really nice, I mean, there's loads of your website's incredible for information for people who actually want to make genuine change in their law firms. But a couple of key documents that I've seen are, you've got your benchmark for your efficiency of contract drafting, or your contract processes benchmark. Can you talk through a little bit about that?
It's just 30 questions. It's aimed at companies who, you know, doing their contracts, and just basically covers how far are you on the journey of putting these different steps in place. We've built a capability maturity model and gave that away, and then we built the benchmark to do it. And in fact, we've got a whole new thing that's come out of the data. So what's been super interesting about looking at that data is that we realized that people were actually doing things in a slightly different sequence to what we thought they would be doing it. So that's been helpful. So that's all about to be updated again. And in fact, I've been writing a book. So that's going to be coming out in the new year.
About
how to fix your commercial contracting, that again builds on all of the stuff we've learned and so on. But what we found is that there's just a kind of a natural order to how you sort this stuff out if you're a company with your contracts. We call it kind of the 3 R's. So you start with the repeatability of making your contracting process repeatable. You have standard templates, you have playbooks, you have some basic processes in place. You then do the robots. You put some basic automation in place. We talked about e-signature, we talked about document assembly, we talked about simple intake process and the intake form and so on. And you know, somewhere to store your contracts in a vaguely sane way. And then it's a refinement process, kind of the continuous improvement ethos from lean and agile and what have you, of just keeping on improving stuff with a focus on the stakeholders. And I think this is the bit that has got so lost in contracting and so on, is why we're doing this, which is what I said about commercial relationships, but who we're doing it for. And I think we've got obsessed as an industry around, you know, the interests of legal. And it's like, this is not about legal and legal risks and things like that. This is about how do companies come together and create great relationships. And therefore, your stakeholders include, you know, your broader business, the SMEs from the business, the different departments, and the other side. And if you aren't defining quality in terms of what's important to both parties and how well you're facilitating this process to bring people together, then you're doing it wrong, is my argument.
Well, I'm very excited about your book. I'm glad that you slipped that in there, because I knew nothing about that. So when's your book coming out?
Well, I've got to finish writing it, but you know, this lockdown's helping.
Okay, good. Well,
New Year, I think.
It won't be out by the time this podcast is out. But follow Alex on LinkedIn, because you should definitely buy the book, because I have absolute faith that it will be something worth reading. So you mentioned about the benchmark system, you know, you gather data about how law firms, like the process, the steps that they're taking already in their contract creation, and then using that data to recommend changes that they can do, see what they're already doing, show them what other things they can do.
Yeah.
And also using that information for yourselves to think of other changes that can happen and recommendations. And then, so within that, the kind of changes and the areas that you're looking at, you mentioned those 3 R's, the repeatable, make sure that the process is repeatable, make sure you've got templates in place. You've got another document on your website about creating contract templates. Listeners should go and check out. I'm going to leave a link in the show notes. And these are things which are not AI, which
AI not included.
To mention.
Yeah, and no blockchain either.
Yeah, they're simple things which you should go out and do. Well, I mean, maybe not so simple, because creating a load of good templates is kind of like, actually, this is the hard work that you've got to put in.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the interesting thing about templates is that, you know, if you braced yourself with a glass or a bottle of wine and, you know, you can use a quill for this, you know, you can actually go and start improving your templates right now, right? And
yes.
And it could only, you know, traditionally it takes within the company about 6 months to change a template for some law of physics I've never quite understood. But you know, it could be done in days, you know, and weeks of just go and improve it, slash a bunch of stuff out. I mean, we regularly take contracts down from, we had an example the other day, which we went from 14 pages to 3 without losing anything, right? And it's totally doable. We follow Ken Adams. Everyone's got a copy of his book on their desk. I hope some of them at least have read it. And, you know, he's part of it, you know, in terms of the clarity and the kind of the rigor that he's brought to the whole topic of how one writes it. But it's also an approach of, can we just be a little bit more reasonable now? Can we just focus on the things that actually matter to the deal? You know, we've got all the AACCM studies that keep going on. They're rerunning the survey. Now we know what the answer is going to be, which is, right, we spend all our negotiation focusing on the wrong topics of liability and termination, and we end up with deals where no one knows what they're buying and selling and what they're paying. Right? That's been the answer for, I think they've been doing that for over 13 years now, 11 years. I don't know. We're doing it all wrong, but it's all fixable. And actually, you can get going pretty fast on getting better.
So the thing that you just mentioned about IACCN doing the research about kind of where the bottlenecks are in, you know, where lawyers are getting held up, spending too much time, being inefficient on particular areas of negotiations. You mentioned, like, you know, the liability, like, you know, there's so much on that. So with these bottlenecks, what are you suggesting instead, or to lawyers who are doing that, what are you going to tell them to do?
Well, so the IACCM study basically goes, they go out every few years and they ask everyone, their members around the world, what are the topics get negotiated and what are the topics go wrong? You know, what get negotiated is liability, indemnities, termination, whatever. What goes wrong is people don't know what they're buying. People don't know what they're paying. Right? The basics. That says that we've had negotiations dominated by legal concerns, and that's unhelpful. This is exasperated because we seem to have got into this rut of increasingly long and unreasonable terms. Terms only seem to get longer and they only seem to get more unreasonable. I think that comes from, it's fundamentally a management issue, actually. It is an issue of team members ultimately incentivized to always take the conservative position, always go for the unreasonable position, because they're worried about finger pointing later. And that comes from a lack of recognition at the organizational level of the sheer cost of slower negotiations and slower contracting and the cost of lost business and all the rest of it that comes from the reality of what happens when those terms hit the rubber. So we're saying, you know, let's start from the point that we're trying to get into bed with the other side, right? We're trying to create a relationship. And in order to do that, how about we stop whacking them around the back of the head, right? How about we start with the thing which is a more pleasant experience? So, you know, the mantra is short, clear, reasonable, relevant terms. And therefore, we focus on the things that really matter. And if we know that the things that go wrong is you don't actually know what you're buying and selling and paying and blah, 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 let's really put the focus on that. And let's have a grown-up conversation within the relevant stakeholders within an organization about the cost of always taking the unreasonable position out of fear, right? As opposed to the value of a faster contract being put in place. And let us have that at a grown-up conversation at a senior level that says we are going to take a position that we're not always going to try to maximize our position, take a maximalist position, but instead we're going to take a reasonable position. And by reasonable, I mean, you know, if two parties of equal power and equal desire to close the contract sat in the room forever banging out, they'd come out with somewhere in the middle, right? And, you know, if you know what you're doing, if you don't know, get out of the industry. But if you know what you're doing, you kind of know what their positions are. That's what I mean by reasonable. It's not giving the farm away. It's just somewhere in the middle that kind of recognizes the interests of both parties. So go there immediately. Just go there immediately. Okay? And then you'll find the whole process is a lot more effective and so on. Right? But and you've got to give air cover to the people in your legal team or whatever to be okay with not always taking the most extreme position. Right? Because we as a corporation recognize that there's a value in getting deals done.
What's the company's response to this?
What we found is fascinating is now you're starting to get the data. So back to the data question, right? So you'll find if you look at my LinkedIn posts and so on, I talk about this as a piece of on being reasonable. I've also got one on being unreasonable, but there's the one on being reasonable. And I actually share data there, right? So we had this extraordinary situation back when we were doing GDPR projects in 2018. We were all fixing all the contracts and all of that nonsense. You know, we had companies with contract signings taking seven times longer to close than other companies. Yet they were all trying to achieve the same thing. And we were kind of doing it the same way. But what was different was, apart from just, you know, and if you're a big company, you're probably a bit of a dysfunctional in terms of getting decisions made and so on. So, you know, we're understandable, right? But the key thing, the determinant, was the reasonableness of the terms. And We actually had an example where one company took 4.5 times longer on average to get its contracts closed because it had one unreasonable position in there. And we could actually show and plot, and we did all sorts of stats and yada yada. And a professor of, you know, demographics running the maths on it. Actually, this clause had a real valid effect, right, on time to close. And interestingly, we then looked into this clause and realized it had actually no value whatsoever for various reasons. When we did that, we tried to understand what was going on with different projects, and we kind of honed in on this was the cause. And that was, for me, an eye-opening experience, because I'd always known, you know, we would know that if we go out with a bit of an unreasonable draft, probably going to get some pushback. But suddenly, we're starting to get real numbers, right, about the impact. And it is shocking how big that impact is. There is no way you're going to make your contracting process 4.5 times faster, right, through putting any level of automation in. Right, there's nothing of, you know, we use all that automation. I can tell you that it doesn't give you that scale of impact, right? And that scale of impact is there free for you right now by going and knocking those terms out. But in order to get rid of those terms, you have to have the right incentives. And so if you're in house, you need to be given air cover, right? You need someone to go.
What do you mean by air cover?
I mean, someone to go, you know, in your broader organization to take a risk, balanced risk perspective to go, yeah, we are incentivized, the company. You know, CEOs don't wake up in the morning going, oh my goodness, I hope we've got millions of indemnities in our contract. They wake up going, where's the sales against target, right? So let us take a more CEO-like perspective of a balanced view of risk and what real risk is in business, right? Which isn't sitting there for 6 months kicking a contract down the road. It's about getting the money in, right, and doing all the rest of it they have to do. This year, let's get that perspective in. And then from a law firm perspective, well, we have a law firm on the other side. We normally have in-house teams. We have a law firm on the other side. We know it's going to take about 4 or 5 times longer to close. Now, we know that because they come in and make a meal out of it that the in-house team wouldn't. Why? Because the in-house team is incentivized to get stuff done as quickly as possible. Whereas the law firm's incentivized to come in and make a hash of it. So stop buying legal services on the billable hour basis if you're in-house, and stop selling it if you're a law firm, if you actually are trying to make the situation better. And if you're not, let's just be honest about it.
Do you think that in part there's this idea in negotiation skills that you're supposed to come in with something unreasonable because
give.
Then... Yeah. Get to the, you're, there's always going to be a compromise. So
yeah.
Come in with the most unreasonable thing you can do, and then you'll reach a compromise. I mean, probably as well as everything that you're saying, that, you know, the billable hours and all of that, you know, these incentives needs to change. Also, training curriculum needs to change. This idea of unreasonableness in negotiations, there has to be a shift.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we are continuing to fight a debate that was kicked off with things like the Harvard Negotiation Project and getting to yes decades ago, right? You know, this is still being played out in the industry as the perspectives on, you know, what should one be fighting for and so on, and how best to game that. And our experience is that the real value, you know, you're never going to use an indemnity, right? No one ever claims under indemnities, right? But if you don't get that contract in, you're not getting that revenue that month, right? That's a real cost, right, that's been foregone. If you want to get your contracts in place quickly, we know that you want to send reasonable terms, because what happens is when it gets read by the other side, they're kind of going through, and as long as there's nothing that really upsets them, they'll just go fine. We know that because we've seen the data of that, because we track all this stuff and so on. You always get someone who's, you know, trying to prove something or whatever, but it's 5, 10, 15% of contracts, right? Most of the time, they go through and they can't find a problem, they'll just sign it. But if they, as soon as they find one problem, you're in. And they're going to start fixing the commas, and they're going to do the rest, and the rest, mm-hmm. Right? Now you piss them off, right? And you're in. I think the data is pretty clear that, you know, if you knock about day-to-day stuff, just make it so that why wouldn't you sign it?
Good piece of advice there. So, lawyers out there, be more reasonable. Stop being unreasonable. Be unreasonable in your innovation.
Yeah, exactly. That's why other essays are about being unreasonable. Don't accept the world as it is.
Yeah.
That kind of unreasonable.
So we've covered quite a lot. So some things, you know, lawyers out there, don't try to automate all your contracts when you're still relying on the billable hours staff. Don't just think that automating a contract is going to get you better contracts if you're then presenting unreasonable terms to the opposition. Stop doing contradictory things and go the whole hog. Do the Alex Hamilton.
Good luck.
So I'm going to link to a lot of those resources that we mentioned today. You've got a great page on your website about with your resources. And also for listeners out there, if you're interested in legal tech terminology, Alex on his website has got this great law tech glossary.
That's very sarcastic.
Lots of, sorry. No, I mean, it's very good.
It's very silly indeed.
I had to check it before, I had to do my studying before this interview.
I love that. You
know, what if these words pop up and I'm like, I mean, Alex. Do you, Alex, have any final points? If listeners have one takeaway from today, what is it?
That we're all barely scratching the surface on this. And I don't want to give the impression at all that Radiance cracked it. I just want to give the impression that, you know, we're really feels like we're just kind of at the beginning of a journey here of really making contracting better. But it's not like you're left behind so much as everyone's been slow to get on this, and there's tons to figure out. And I hope everyone joins us in that journey.
Great. Join Alex on his special journey. The change. He's welcoming you all to go and be a pioneer alongside him. Great. Okay, thank you, Alex. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
It's been great. Thank you for having me.
So that's the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed it and learnt something new. Do check out the links in the show notes. You can also head to studylegalenglish.com/episode97 to find all of those links. Do buy Alex's book when it comes out. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic. I'd love to hear your comments on this interview. As always, send me an email to louise@studylegalenglish.com or get in touch on social media. Join the Facebook group, find me on Instagram, just search for @legalenglisher. So thanks for listening and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Study Legal English podcast. If you really want to get ahead, why not become a member and gain access to many learning resources? Visit studylegalenglish.com/pricing.